Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
You know, I'd spent my career trying to figure out strangers, Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, Vince Lombardi, and make them familiar to me. And here I had these very familiar figures that I was dealing with, and I was worried that they would become strangers. That didn't happen, but there was a lot that I discovered. You know, we all deal with the mythology of our families and rarely have a biographer go back and find out what really was happening.
Hello, and welcome to Why Is This Happening? With me, your host, Chris Hayes. A few years ago, there was a New York Times Magazine story that was an excerpt of a book, and it was written by the legendary media critic David Carr. David Carr, who died several years ago, much too young, and his death was really powerfully felt by so many people across the industry. He'd touched many lives. He'd been an incredible mentor. He was an amazing raconteur. And he had written this book, this memoir called Night of the Gun. And it was a really fascinating book, and this excerpt was in the New York Times Magazine, and I read that, and then I read the book. And what made it fascinating was that he was writing a memoir about the darkest period in his own life, and that was a period in which he became a very, very intense addict, drug addict. Crack, I believe, was what he was addicted to. He lost his job. He had these twin girls. The sort of dramatic climax of that excerpt is basically like leaving the twin baby girls in a car in the Minnesota winter to go buy drugs and then like getting high and forgetting they're in the car. And part of what made that story really interesting was it was a memoir, but he says in the beginning that he's now a reporter and he wanted to go back and like re-report his life. So it's a memoir, but it's also like an excavation. It's an excavation that happens whereby he takes his recollection as a kind of first pass. And then he went back and he like pulled rental records to make sure that he was living in the apartment he said he was and interviewing people from that time and sort of matching up what memory is, the stories he told himself, and what reality is. And I always think that's a really interesting genre of storytelling to go back through your life with the tools that you have as a journalist or as a researcher or as a historian to try to match it up. And my guest today did that as well. It's a different story. It's not a story about himself. It's not a memoir. It's a story about his family. But he's a fairly legendary author. His name's David Marinus. He's a journalist and an author. He's won the Pulitzer Prize twice. He's an associate of the Washington Post. He's written a variety of biographies that are extremely acclaimed and well-received. I first encountered his work when I read his Bill Clinton biography, which is excellent, called First in His Class. He also wrote a very good and very revealing Barack Obama biography called Barack Obama, The Story. If I'm not mistaken, there's a lot of stuff in there that had never been uncovered before. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that he is the first person to uncover the Chum Gang, which was the name of the stoner friends that Barack Obama was friends with in their Hawaiian prep school. He also, I think, is the first to uncover the detail that Barack Obama's like signature go-to move would be to like take a hit of a joint and pass it around and then go and then grab it from someone like two people later and yell intercepted and then take another hit of the joint. That if I'm not mistaken, is also a David Marinus find. So there's all sorts of great stuff in that biography as well. So he's a really talented biographer and historian. And he undertook something fascinating in his latest book, which is called A Good American Family, in which he did an excavation of his own family story and his father and mother's story. And as you'll hear, it's a very interesting story that intersects with a really crucial moment in American history. His parents were radicals on the political left, and they met in radical circles. And his father was a newspaper man, but when David was 3 years old, something happened that meant that his father lost his job and almost sort of lost his livelihood and his sort of place in American society. And this book, A Good American Family, is a recounting of that. It's an excavation of that time, both through the first-person eyes of memoir, writing a book about your family, and also the historical tools of sifting through the National Archives and going through contemporaneous accounts to reconstruct this profound experience his family had, which is also a well-documented story of the Red Scare McCarthyism, but provides a kind of insight into a whole bunch of themes that are really germane right now. A society under the sway of paranoia, the pull of radical politics, the means by which people find themselves in an ideological space that they later may come to regret or may come to see as wrong-footed, and the ways in which entire society can fall under the sway of a kind of fever and how that fever breaks. All of that is part of the story that David Marinus tells in his excellent new book, A Good American Family. Take a listen. So you're an incredibly accomplished writer. You've won 2 Pulitzer Prizes. That's exactly 2 more than I've managed to get. And you've written about public figures, big sort of public lives, big meaty biographies. It's a book about your own family. Where did that come from? Where did you grow up? What was it like?
I was born in Detroit and lived there for most of the first 7 years of my life. And that's where the central part of this book takes place. Our family eventually found salvation, you might say, in Madison, Wisconsin, when I was about 7 going on 8, 1957. Joseph McCarthy had just died. The Milwaukee Braves were on their way to the World Series. Life seemed good. I stayed in Madison with my family through the University of Wisconsin, then went off to the East Coast and ended up at the Washington Post in 1977. So I've been there for 42 years.
The events in this book, which are about your father, how much did you know about them? How present were they when you were growing up?
You know, by the time, Chris, that I reached sort of consciousness, my father had moved past that era. So I knew about it a little bit. It was in the just sort of the shadows of our lives. But by the time, he wouldn't talk about that. But what he did teach me about was never fall for any rigid ideology, search for the truth wherever you can find it. All these great lessons of journalism he imparted on me. And he didn't really want to talk about his earlier life and the difficulties he endured.
When did you first start to dig into what had happened, particularly when you were 3 years old?
I had previously read the transcript of when he was called before the House Un-American Activities Committee. That was public record. So my brother, my sister, and I all knew about that transcript, but it was in the background to me. I was dealing with other things, with Barack Obama and Bill Clinton and politics in Washington. And especially while my parents were still alive, I didn't want to deal with this in any serious way. And then probably about 6 years ago, it just started to take hold of me. And I can't write a book unless I'm obsessed about the subject. And this started to obsess me. And I really only started digging into it, I would say, in 2015.
So I want to talk about your father.
Yes.
His name was Elliot. A fascinating, fascinating man in many different ways. Who was he?
Elliot Marinus grew up in Brooklyn on Coney Island. He went to Abraham Lincoln High School during the Depression years, the same years that Arthur Miller and 2 Nobel Prize winners were there. It was a very progressive school where the principal carried around Emerson's essays in his back pocket. And then Elliot went off to the University of Michigan. He thought he was a baseball player, and then he looked at the Big Ten baseball and realized that wasn't for him. But he eventually rose to become the editorial director of the Michigan Daily, which I have to say, in that era, I've looked at all of those issues from 1934 to 1940. It was a terrific newspaper, a daily newspaper that carried very sophisticated book reviews, a series on the Tennessee Valley Authority. It interviewed every serious writer who came into town. Also covered national and international events. So that's where he got his training, and that's where he was radicalized, I would say, and was considered on the left wing of that newspaper, which was pretty left wing to start with.
Right. So he shows up. He's a Brooklyn kid. He shows up in Michigan in 1936, and that is where his politics begin to incubate. What were those politics? How did he come to them?
Well, the politics were probably Marxist. Over the course of those 4 years, they evolved further and further in that direction. He was motivated by what I would call the better instincts of humankind, racial justice, economic equality. Growing up during the Depression in Brooklyn, where he saw a lot of capitalism's failures. And I think those events really struck a strong chord with him, and he turned toward communism as an answer. He would later say that he was stubborn in his ignorance about that, but in my investigation of him, I read hundreds of essays and stories he wrote at the Michigan Daily, and you could see the gradual evolution towards that Marxist viewpoint.
And it's more than an ideology, right? I mean, he would essentially come to be a member of the Communist Party, right?
He worked for a paper that was a communist newspaper in Detroit later. And there's one indication that in 1947, he was a member of the Communist Party. My mother, no doubt, was. My mother ran for student office at the University of Michigan on the Young Communist League ticket. So, she was actually more of the ideologue than my dad. I really sort of came to understand that during the investigation of my own family. You know, I'd spent my career trying to figure out strangers, Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, Vince Lombardi, and make them familiar to me. And here I had these very familiar figures that I was dealing with, and I was worried that they would become strangers. That didn't happen, but there was a lot that I discovered. You know, we all deal with the mythology of our families and rarely have a biographer go back and find out what really was happening.
Yeah, it sounds sort of terrifying to me, actually. Like, I, you know what I mean? Like, I just, it feels like sifting, like I'm a little kid and I'm about to find something I don't want to know about.
Yes.
When I think about the projects of excavating my own parents, like from a journalistic biographer, with the level of rigor that you would bring to that project.
Well, it was both exhilarating and frightening. When I saw that my father was writing essays rationalizing the Nazi-Soviet pact in 1939, and that my mother, at a student convention in Madison, Wisconsin, ironically, they hadn't ended up there yet, but it was a national convention, she was trying to rationalize the Soviet invasion of Finland. I mean, those were kind of shocking things for me to deal with. On the other hand, you know, when I found the statement that my father wrote that he wanted to deliver to the committee when he was called before it in 1952, it was thrilling. It's a powerful, powerful defense of freedom of speech and the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And also when I found the 150 letters that my father wrote to my mother in World War II when he was the commander of an all-black unit, and the pride that he took in that and the way that he was giving his soldiers a fair shake in a segregated and incredibly racist military environment. That was prideful for me. So it was both, you know, but every step along the way, I was discovering new things.
Your parents, do they meet through radical politics on the campus?
It's a wonderful story, Chris. My uncle, my mother's older brother, was one of three Michigan students who went off. The day he graduated, he sailed from New York to France, took a train across France, climbed over the Pyrenees Mountains, and joined the International Brigade to fight in the Spanish Civil War. Three students did that from Michigan. There were a few thousand from the United States and Canada. He fought in that war. I got to trace his route when my wife and I went to Spain as part of the reporting for this. And when he survived, as did one of the other Michigan students, a man named Elman Service, who went on to become a great anthropologist in California. But the third member of that group, Ralph Nefus, was captured by Franco's troops and executed.
Wow.
In a church in Alcañiz in Spain. And in any case, when Service and my uncle Bob Cummins came back from the war, survived it, there was a grand celebration at the Union at the University of Michigan. Bob Cummins's younger sister, Mary Cummins, 18 years old, was there to celebrate for her older brother, and covering the event for the Michigan Daily was
amazing.
Elliot Marinus, and that's where my parents met.
So the big party to celebrate a returning survivor of the Spanish Civil War on the anti-fascist side.
Yes.
Your leftist uncle, who motivated by anti-fascism
very much
politics,
so
took up arms, risked his life, manages, he's one of three people, one of whom dies, comes back, and there's a big welcome home party for him. His sister's there, and your dad's there covering it, and they meet at a party for a returning soldier of the Spanish Civil War.
Yes, it's all sort of all comes together right there. And, you know, those Spanish Civil War veterans were labeled premature anti-fascists by the American government. All of them were hounded, too, in the same way that my father later was. As a matter of fact, my uncle Bob Cummins and my father were both called before the committee the same week in 1952 when HUAC came to Detroit.
So your mom's family, I mean, was she raised with these politics since she and her brother both had them?
No, I don't think so at all. I mean, my grandfather, her father, was born in the side of a hill in north central Kansas. Went to the University of Kansas, actually did not graduate, but became an engineer. It was during a period when he could do that. He couldn't afford to go to school all 4 years. Bounced around during the Depression as a civil engineer. Eventually, he and his wife decided to move to Ann Arbor because they wanted their children to have the best chance at schooling, both in the public schools there and at the University of Michigan. But he probably started as a modest Main Street Republican, and during the course of the Depression and the New Deal, evolved into a Roosevelt Democrat, but was by no means radical.
You know, it's funny when I think about the Spanish Civil War, I think about Orwell's writing and his yes. experience there. And, you know, what he experienced there gets at one of the sort of central themes in this story, which is the kind of clash between the ideology that motivates a person to go and fight for the forces of freedom and liberation against tyranny and a vision of a better future, and the reality of how airless and claustrophobic and sometimes downright devious and malicious, like the actual entity of organized communism was.
Oh, totally. And, you know, it's interesting that by the time I became a reader, my father had me read all of Orwell, all of the essays, the great essays, all, you know, Homage to Catalonia, the whole thing. And you're right. The communist involvement in the Spanish Civil War was deadly, manipulative. They were fighting true against Hitler and Franco and Mussolini. And in that sense, they were supporting the loyalists and the Republicans on the what I would call the correct side of the battle.
Yes, but I would agree with you.
But they had prisons where they sent their own fighters who weren't following the party line. They had, you know, in Orwell's book, you see this preposterous internal battle in the streets of Barcelona between the communists and the anarchists. And there were all kinds of divisions going on, as have always been there on the left in America and in the world. But in this case, it was much more violent.
So your parents meet, they fall in love, and your father goes off to a career as a journalist, right?
Yes.
He fights in the war.
He volunteered right after Pearl Harbor. He was at first a private and then applied for officer training school. And one of the most stunning discoveries that I had during the course of this, you know, I got all of his FBI files in two batches. The first batch came to me about 2 years after I started the project, and the second batch, the third year. And in that second batch, there was, I discovered, an earlier investigation of my father by military intelligence. They went
wow.
because he was applying for officer candidate school. And they went back to the University of Michigan. They interviewed professors, fellow students, landlords, and probably 12 out of 15 said very positive things about Elliot. Three did not. One of those three that didn't stunned me because I knew this person. It was Morton Mintz, who was a legendary reporter at the Washington Post. I worked with him briefly. I was his editor on the investigative staff. He was 4 years younger than my dad. He succeeded him in that post as the editorial director of the Michigan Daily. And when the military intelligence investigators interviewed him, he said very negative things about my father, that he should not be an officer, that he was a Marxist who followed the Soviet line, and he wasn't to be trusted.
Wow. There's no way your dad knew that.
I don't think my dad ever knew that in his whole life. As a matter of fact, when my father would come visit me in Washington at the Washington Post, he and Mort met, and it seemed to be a friendly relationship. And Mort knew my mother because they both went to Ann Arbor High School. So Mort Mintz was 95 years old when I read that report.
Wow.
Still alive. I first contacted him by email. I said, "Dear Mort, you know, I have a very difficult subject to bring up with you, but I know you've devoted your life to dealing with hard subjects and the truth." And then I wrote out the entire transcript of what he had said. He wrote me back the next morning and said, "Dear David, I don't remember the details, but I consider that the biggest shame of my life."
Wow.
That made me feel terrible, Chris, because I wasn't trying to make him feel bad at that age.
You know? Yeah. No. Well, it's better than a subject line like, "Yo, dude, I heard what you said about my dad."
Right. I guess so. Then I went to
come to your house.
Yeah. You know, so I wrote him back and said, "Look, that wasn't my intent. My father learned from that era. He doesn't hold grudges about that. He was a forgiving human being. I didn't put this in the writing, but I didn't want Mort to go to his grave, you know, feeling terrible about this." Right. So then I went to visit him when I got back to D.C. I was in Madison at that point when I wrote him, and visited him in his apartment. And we had another long talk about it. He again expressed his shame about it. I think we resolved it as much as we could. And people got caught up in that era in a lot of complex and difficult ways.
So he clears this background check. He serves. He commands an all-black battalion. He comes back from the war, and he gets work as a newspaper man, right?
At the Detroit Times. I should say, first of all, that getting that job as the commander of an all-black unit was a particular slot. They gave those jobs as commanders either to Southern racists, who the Army figured knew how to deal with black people.
Jesus.
Yeah, really, seriously. Or to Northern radicals. who would like that job. And so that's the slot.
That's a real thing. There were two.
Yes.
Two kinds of typologies of white officers that were put in charge of commanding black troops: Southern white racists and Northern white radicals.
There's a military historian named Ulysses Lee who wrote a 700-page book about what was called Negro troops in World War II, and he has a long section about that exact experience.
So they knew, like, it wasn't an accident. They knew, like, he got that job because of they knew what his politics were.
Well, most white officers didn't want that job because they figured it was a dead end. My father took it as, you know, and went with it. Anyway, so yes, that was what happened in World War II. Then he came back, and he had a job at the Detroit Times when he left. It was waiting for him when he got back. He was sort of the chief rewrite man on the Detroit Times copy desk. The Detroit Times no longer exists. It died in 1960, but it was a Hearst-owned newspaper.
And when you were 3 years old, that's 1952?
Yes.
What happens?
The House Un-American Activities Committee, chaired by John Stevens Wood, a Georgia Southern racist who had once been in the Ku Klux Klan and some other dark things in his past, came to Detroit to hold hearings on communism in the Detroit area.
Oh, it's a field hearing.
It's a field hearing. And they did those in various places. That's what Hollywood was a field hearing in 1951, the second Hollywood hearings. They went to Detroit for a specific reason, which was they wanted to go after the United Auto Workers Local 600 there, which was the largest union local in the country and had communist influence inside it. So that was their purpose. And when
like hunting communists, basically. They're traipsing around the country hunting communists.
Well, you know, they know who the communists are already. They're hunting publicity for it to try to stir up fear. You know, going after Hollywood, I mean, that was solely for the publicity of it, not because some screenwriter was going to violently overthrow the government. So that, yes, they went hunting communists in Michigan, in the Union. And what happened was that in 1943, the FBI in Detroit had recruited a woman named Berenice Baldwin, who was a grandmother, eventually, to infiltrate the Michigan Communist Party. She rose in its ranks to become the secretary. She had every name of everyone who'd ever been in the party from 1943 until she came in from the cold 9 years later to testify in public for the first time at those UAC hearings in Detroit.
What possesses a person to do that for nine? Like, it just seems like a lot. Like, why would you do that?
Well, she was paid. She was. She was not.
Simple answer.
Yeah, she was not one of those former communists who'd been disillusioned or felt peer pressure or whatever to name names. She did it basically because it was her job.
So the FBI recruits her. They place her in there. She climbs up the ladder. They pay her the whole time. Is just an active, essentially double agent for them.
Yes. She befriended all of the communists in Detroit. She'd go to their wedding parties, to their birth showers. And then she came in from the cold and testified, and she named hundreds of names. So my father and my uncle, neither of whom were involved with the United Auto Workers, were essentially collateral damage. On February 29th, Leap Day of 1952, she testified. A agent for HUAC visited the Detroit Times and issued a subpoena to my father.
Whoa.
And he was summarily fired that day.
Fired. Did he see any of this coming?
That's a great question that I can't quite answer. I don't think so.
I mean, you think about him reading in his own paper that HUAC announces field hearings on the communist menace in Detroit.
Yes. Several weeks before they came to Detroit, a subversive activities control board in Washington held a hearing. And that's actually where Bernice Baldwin first came in from the cold and testified there. So in the book, I write that I can only imagine my dad at the Detroit Times office, probably, reading it on the wire, all of these, probably colleagues talking about, oh, they're coming to Detroit. That'll be juicy. And the adrenaline that must have been throwing through my father at that moment, the adrenaline of fear of what was going to happen. So, yes, for maybe that a few weeks, he knew what was coming.
So he is fired. He is subpoenaed by HUAC. He is named by this informant, subpoenaed by HUAC, and fired the same day.
Yes. And then a week later, called to testify, he types out this powerful statement that I found 63 years later in the National Archives in Washington. And there's something, the statement itself is a brilliant exposition on freedom of speech and the Bill of Rights and freedom of the press. But what struck me, it starts by saying statement of Elliot Marinus. And he typed it out on an old manual typewriter when they still existed. And I don't know if you ever typed on a typewriter, Chris, but the keys would sometimes stick.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a hunt and peck typist. He was, he was violently typing out. And he was always typing the wrong letter and the keys were sticking and he'd correct it. But anyway, it starts by saying statement of Elliot Marinus. And the S in statement stuck and went up a half notch. And it was literally when I was looking at that statement and saw that what I call the imperfect S, that everything, for the first time in my life, I was 65 years old, and really for the first time, the whole thing washed over me about what my father had endured, that I had not really allowed myself is the wrong word, but I had not really felt it in that way before. Thinking about him that night before he's about to testify, banging that out, and what he was going through. Because he had moved on and had a very successful career, because our family didn't really talk about it much, although we knew it was somewhere in the background, I had really never allowed myself to deal with it frontally like that until I saw that statement.
At this point, it's a week later, he does not have a job. He writes a statement, and does he deliver it in person?
He's not allowed to. Elliot says, I'd like to deliver a statement about my interpretation of what it means to be an American. Because, of course, this was the Un-American Activities Committee. And Chairman Wood said, basically, you can submit your statement, but you can't read it unless you are contrite and seek absolution and name names, which Elliot refused to do. He took his Fifth Amendment rights, invoked those against incriminating himself, which, of course, the committee took as an obvious sign of guilt even though it's in the Bill of Rights. He refused to do anything that they wanted in those terms. And so they said, you can submit your statement for the record, but you cannot read it. So it was basically lost to history for six decades until I found his file, you know, in the UOC files at the National Archives. And there it was.
What's the arc after for the your arc, father after this happens?
So at this point, I'm not quite three. There are three children. My brother Jim is almost seven. My sister Jeannie is five, and my mother. So there are five of us. And we bounce around basically for 5 years. First moved to his family's, his parents' flat in Coney Island. He finds work there very briefly for a newspaper called The Compass, which folded right as soon as he got there, basically. It was a liberal newspaper, a sort of a successor to the famous PM, but it was already dying when he got there. Then we moved back to Ann Arbor and lived with my mother's parents for a while. Again, I'm not quite conscious at this point. And then we moved to Cleveland. He landed a job on the copy desk of the Cleveland Plain Dealer because some friends of his from the University of Michigan were there and hired him. But very soon after he got there, the FBI visited the publisher and said, you know, you just hired a communist.
Jesus.
And so he was fired from that job.
So that's the way it works. Like, they know. They're tracking you.
Oh, yes.
You show up at a major American city newspaper daily, and somehow that is transmitted back to the FBI central office, and they send FBI to your employer to be like, you just hired a commie.
Yes. As a matter of fact, when I got his FBI file, I counted up, and there were 37 FBI agents who were tracking him for those years from, say, 1947 to 1957. 10 years, long after he had not been a member of the Communist Party. The last record they have of him actually as a Communist Party member is 1947. So this is 52. He's or 54, I'm sorry. He's fired from the Cleveland Plain Dealer. We move back to Detroit. He's out of the newspaper business. He can't get, you know, he's blacklisted. He worked for a progressive union sort of five and dime that sold party favors to labor unions, bizarre job, which I kind of like because I'd go to their office and get all these slingshots and stuff. Then there was a strike by the typographers against the newspapers in Davenport, Iowa, and Rock Island, Illinois, in the Quint Cities area. My father was hired by that strike paper to be one of the editors. Sort of, you know, it was starting to his recovery, finally back into the newspaper business. That was a failing enterprise. It was a wonderful place for me to write about because it was full of all these misbegotten souls, you know, communists, ex-communists, sort of people on the fringes of the newspaper business. And they put out a really good newspaper, but it had no, the typographers union backed it for a while and then they ran out of money. But one of the things that newspaper would do is they'd run a column called Hello, Wisconsin, written by William T. Evue, who was the old progressive editor and publisher of the Madison Capital Times, former best friends of the La Follettes, came out of that La Follette progressive tradition. And somehow Evue saw a copy of this paper that was being put out by the strikers in Iowa. And among my father's many talents, he was a really good editor, and he loved layout and writing headlines. And so Evue looks at this paper and says, Jesus, this is better than our paper. Who's doing this? Finds out it's my dad, hires him. We arrive in Madison in 1957, as I said, right after Joe McCarthy died, and that was our salvation. Madison saved us. My father then worked at the Capital Times from 1957 until he retired in 1982 as the editor of the newspaper. And during that period, he was an inspiration and trained dozens and dozens of journalists. He brought women out of the society pages and gave them serious reporting jobs. He hired the first African Americans for the paper. So, you know, that's the story of my dad after that.
I want to talk a little bit about sort of how you understand the period of frenzy and the sort of in the wilderness and then the fever breaking that sort of allows your father to kind of re-enter American society. And I want to talk about that right after we take this quick break.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
What's remarkable to me about the story is the stakes are so high. He's basically caught up in the grips of the peak of, you know, the Red Scare.
Yes.
He's named by an informant. He's fired a week later when he gets a subpoena. He's blacklisted, essentially, chased out of jobs by the FBI, showing up at his employer. He bounces around and then ends up back working for the Capital Times in 1957, right after the death of Joseph McCarthy. And I think there's this general feeling about that period that, like, there was a kind of collective mania, a collective frenzy that then breaks, right? We think about the moment of, you know, when McCarthy is confronted in the hearing at long last, have you no decency, sir, at long last. How do you understand it? How did you come to understand it, researching it for the book?
You know, the hysteria started right after World War II. And I think it has several components to it. One was political. It was the Republican Party seeing an opportunity to dismantle the New Deal and the progressive politics that had been going on for 20 years by latching on to anti-communism. That was blatant politics as part of it.
So they very much understand that this is a tool to destroy Roosevelt-inflected New Dealism and the political dominance of a Democratic Party by basically tying it to a foreign adversary.
Yes. And in one way or another, as you know also well, the Republicans have played this card for 50 years, sort of that we're the patriots, the Democrats are soft on communism, soft on everything. And so that was the, you know, Richard Nixon was doing that in California. He was on the House Un-American Activities Committee before my father was called before it, but was there with several of the members who were there in 1952. And they were all taking advantage of it in one way or another. Then Joe McCarthy comes along in 1950. And in so many ways, he reminds me of Donald Trump because he wasn't an ideologue. He saw this as an opportunity to make his name and to get publicity and to ride it as far as he could. So he gives this speech in Wheeling, West Virginia in 1950 about, I have here in my hand the names of 205 communists, which was completely fictional. He didn't have those names, but it caught on with the press, sort of like Trump caught on because of his sensationalism running for president. And he played it all the way through to 1954. And by that time, actually, it was the Republicans that did him in. It was Eisenhower who, in 1952, to win election, sort of allowed McCarthy to do his thing. But by 54, when McCarthy was going after the army, Eisenhower's army, it was a different matter.
Well, and the press phenomenon part of it is so fascinating to me, McCarthy, because when you compare him to Trump, like, he's not a particularly impressive individual. He has a kind of knack for demagoguery. He's got a sort of canny sense of the kind of paranoia and the fears and what gets people going. But he's also a real media phenomenon at the time.
He liked the press, kind of like Trump secretly, you know, buddies up with the press.
Yes, loves the press. Oh, my God. There's not a single person in the United States of America more obsessed with the press, with the media, with coverage, more desirous of their affection and adoration than
Donald
Trump.
Now, it was a different era, so television wasn't really a big deal until Edward R. Murrow helped do him in, and the Army-McCarthy hearings were televised. But the press in that era was, you know, the wire services, the National Chicago Tribune, Washington Post, New York Times, and they all, you know, McCarthy would invite them into his Senate offices, and they'd drink afterwards. And several of those reporters, to their shame, saw that if they wrote about McCarthy's charges, they'd get on the front page. And that's part of what was happening. Now, there were several very strong reporters who stood up against him, including Murray Marder, who I got to meet right, you know, he was at the end of his career when I got to the Post in 1977. But there weren't that many. Edward R. Murrow won in television. And then you have the Korean War and the legitimate fear of Soviet agents. There were several trials from 1950 to 1953 where it was shown that certain people were Soviet agents.
Right.
Most communists weren't. My dad was certainly not, and most members of the party were not. But they would use that to say that you know, they were undermining the danger within, and also that anyone who was a member of the Communist Party prima facie wanted the violent overthrow of the U.S. government.
What's interesting, when I go back to that period and I think about it now and I read about it now, you know, one of the things that I'm trying to think about the right way to say this, because I don't want to sound like I'm defending Joe McCarthy. The approach of the Communist International under Stalin's control really is pretty messed up and insidious. like, you know, when you read about, so like the European Communist parties, like the Italians and the French, mm-hmm. and of course there's those parties have incredible, you know, people with egalitarian convictions and anti-fascist convictions who put their life on the line in the resistance, who had fought against Mussolini, who had fought against the Nazis.
Yep.
But they are part of an organization that is essentially, Stalin is attempting to pull the strings of and essentially control the domestic politics of all of Europe in this very like dishonest, duplicitous, manipulative fashion.
Paranoid and murderous.
Yeah. It's like it is crazy. I didn't realize the degree to which like it really was the case that like Stalin's minions really were attempting to just tell all the communist parties of the world like what to do and how to go about their business in a way that was like made them essentially foreign agents.
That's very true. And, you know, it's undeniable, and it's one of the things I try to deal with honestly in this book. You know, my parents were not foreign agents, but they were.
No, that's not what I'm saying.
But they were members of the party, you know, during some of that period, and they were rationalizing the atrocities of the Soviets in various ways, which are indefensible and, to me, inexplicable. But I do know human nature, and I know that people can be self-delusional if they really want to believe something, you know, and that holds true no matter what your ideology is, you know.
Absolutely.
So,
yeah, it's that tension, particularly pre the Hungarian uprising in 56 and the tanks rolling in, which is a moment of real disruption among a lot of people, as sort of scales falling from the eyes from a lot of members of the Communist Party who are, you know, throughout the world and particularly in the West, who are say, wait a second.
Can I say something there?
Yep.
My parents were no longer Communist Party members by then, but my brother told me that he remembers seeing my mother ironing clothes, listening to the radio when Imre Nagy is executed, the Hungarian communist leader who was not communist enough for the Soviets. And tears were rolling down her eyes. And he took that as sort of an indication of her. I mean, she'd already understood what was going on, but that was kind of the final straw for my mother, I think.
That's really interesting because it is that moment is really important, I think, of the development of folks that were kind of like leftist, egalitarian, anti-fascists who had been drawn to the party because of those commitments, a lot of times to racial equality as well. And, you know, the sort of realization of what exactly the Stalin machine looks like and what it means.
Yep. You know, and there were points before that. There were the purges in the late 30s. There was the as I said earlier, the Nazi-Soviet
pact.
Yeah, I
mean, there's a Nazi-Soviet pact when you have, the, you know, a huge part of the left make this insane, you know, 180.
Yep. Totally.
And what's so crazy is that happens after the Spanish Civil War.
Yes, I know.
So that, all these people are ready to marching off to fight fascism.
Well, it was it created a split. I mean, a lot of the veterans from that point on turned away.
Yes.
There was a split in the American Student Union at that point, a very strong one of those who defended and those who didn't. But yes, all along, there are these benchmarks all along the way from the 30s through 1956, where you could say, well, why wasn't that the point where you turned away?
What do you think about the mania, and what is your sort of lesson about that? I mean, I think that people, there's a sort of historical referent where people think, I think, do sort of compare McCarthy and Trump. They think about the sort of collective frenzy, the kind of media savvy, the demagoguery, and the sort of personal mediocrity. And and I guess I wonder, like, it is the case that in the end, right, McCarthy loses. And he loses in the sense of he's sort of disgraced. The worst excesses fall by the wayside. Your father, for instance, can have a life in America and be a member of society and not have it hang over him and not have a cost him jobs. And it always sort of feels like, what's the end to this story? Is there some sort of...
Well, let me tell you one story. One of the members of the House Un-American Activities Committee, when my father was called before it, was a Michigan congressman named Charles Potter. Potter had gone off to fight in World War II, fought heroically, lost both legs falling on a landmine in the Colmar Pocket, and came back as one of those young veterans like Richard Nixon who made his name in politics as a staunch anti-communist. He ran for the Senate right after the 52 hearings, won, was a senator from Michigan, and placed on the subcommittee with Joe McCarthy. And there firsthand, he saw the machinations and exaggerations and recklessness of McCarthy, and was part of the group that helped push him out eventually and censured him. But it took Potter another decade. In the 1960s, he wrote a book that was called Days of Shame.
Wow.
And, you know, it laid out all of the mistakes that the Republican Party, that Congress had made, allowing that era to happen. You know, he defended the Fifth Amendment in this book. I mean, it's really quite striking what he saw when he saw the light. And I can only wonder, who's going to write that book 10 years from now? You know, what Republican, and will it take 10 years? And Trump says, you know, he wanted his Roy Cohn. Maybe he got him now. But a lot of us are saying, where's Margaret Chase Smith? You know, the Republican senator from Maine who stood up to McCarthy. Who's doing that in the Republican Party now?
Roy Cohn is an interesting character because obviously he is the personification of the through line from one period to the other. Cohn gets his start.
Yep.
As a staunch anti-communist on HUAC, you know, sort of destroying people's lives.
And he was McCarthy's chief of staff and orchestrating a lot of those hearings. And then he had his own undoing. That's what the Army-McCarthy hearings were all about, a scandal involving Roy Cohn and one of his close male friends who he helped get out of an Army position. And then McCarthy took on the Army in that fight in every possible way that he could.
So Cohn ends up being at the center of the sort of downfall of McCarthy. And yet Cohn, to sort of give the other side of this, right, McCarthy dies a basically a disgraced figure. He's censured. Cohn goes on to live nine more lives.
Yes, and becomes a character in one of the great plays in American modern history, and befriends a young real estate developer in New York called Donald Trump, and teaches Trump how to manipulate the system the way he did. So yeah, it's quite a remarkable and demoralizing story.
On that happy note. I thought we were gonna end. I was like, I was driving us towards ending on the sort of satisfaction of comeuppance. And then I was like, well, there also is the Roy Cohn part of this, which is like he basically skated, got away with everything.
Well, look at my dad was, you know, one of the things I want to say about my father is that so many old leftists, you know, were either turned into neocons, staunch anti-communists, driven by that, or into sort of demoralized, bitter people. My father maintained somehow his optimism all the way through that and all the way through the rest of his life. And so even in these dark times that we're dealing with today, I think my father would be one of the optimists.
Was he, did he have left politics when he died?
No. I mean, he had classic liberal politics. Yeah. I don't know whether he would, I have a nephew who's convinced that his grandfather would love Bernie Sanders. I'm not so sure. I think he was more practical than that. Mm. Probably Kamala Harris or Elizabeth Warren.
But he did have, he stayed broadly on the left, meaning like he was a liberal and he was
very
a Democrat,
so.
And he was resistant to sort of conservatism, reactionary movements.
Yes, but he understood it, as Orwell, who was someone he admired greatly, did, the excesses of totalitarianism on the left and the right. He was far from that anymore.
David Marinus, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, author, biographer, associate editor, Washington Post. His latest book, A Good American Family, about his dad and his mom and his family and their intersection with one of the most fascinating and terrifying moments in American social and political life. David, thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris.
Once again, my great thanks to David Marinus, who's the author of A Good American Family, associate editor of the Washington Post, two-time Pulitzer winner. You, of course, can get his new book, A Good American Family, wherever you like to get your books. I recommend IndieBound, which sells through a local independent bookstores. You could always tweet us, hashtag withpod, email withpod@gmail.com. We always love to hear your feedback. Why Is This Happening is presented by MSNBC and NBC News, produced by the All In team, and features music by Eddie Cooper. You can see more of our work, including links to things we mentioned here, by going to nbcnews.com/whyisthishappening.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.